This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade, and this is One Nation. Welcome. We begin tonight with a historic Fox News alert. President Trump's peace deal in the Middle East unfolding in real time, right now, right before your eyes. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas continuing to hold strong as we await the imminent release of at least 20 living hostages and the release of the approximately 28 bodies of those deceased, although they're having trouble finding all of them. I know. President Trump is now on his way to the Middle East, literally in the air, where he'll address the Knesset, that's Israel's legislature, and then he'll meet with the hostage families, and we hope with the released hostages. The president speaking to the press before boarding Air Force One just a few hours ago.
This is going to be a very special time, and I guess if you read your own papers and your own networks, everybody's very excited about this moment in time. This is a very special event. They had 500,000 people yesterday and today in Israel. And also the Muslim and Arab countries are all cheering. Everybody's cheering at one time. That's never happened before.
I hear you. The president's also expecting to sit down with the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. The two are great friends. They have had nothing but praise for each other as they look for a new way forward. This has been brokered by President Trump, and they know it.
Because tomorrow, children will return to their border. This is a historic event that blends sorrow over the release of murders and joy over the return of the hostages. This is a historic event that some did not believe would happen, but our fighters believed. Many among the people believed, and I believed.
So joining me now for the latest, National Security Correspondent Jennifer Griffin. Jennifer, you've seen so much in this region. Tell me what the latest is.
Well, Brian, it's really an extraordinary day here in Israel, one filled with emotion and anticipation. A historic day. President Trump is en route to Israel with members of his cabinet on board Air Force One. He spoke to reporters earlier tonight on Air Force One.
Mr. President, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, has not gone so far as to say the war is over. In your view, is the war between Israel and Hamas over?
War is over. War is over. Okay. Do you understand that?
People have been streaming to Hostage Square in Tel Aviv all day. The 20 living hostages will be handed over by Hamas to the Red Cross at three locations inside Gaza. The Red Cross will transfer the living hostages first to Israeli forces in areas within Gaza that are controlled by the IDF. Hamas is not supposed to film or humiliate the hostages on the way out. The IDF will bring the hostages to Re'im Air Base, just inside Israel along the Gaza border, at which point they'll reunite with immediate family members, medical professionals, and psychologists before being flown to three Tel Aviv hospitals. As medical staff prepared to receive the hostages earlier today, Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, and his wife visited Ikalov Hospital in Tel Aviv, leaving notes on each hospital bed, which read, "So good that you are back home." Billboards across Israel pressing Trump, Rubio, Witkoff, and Jared Kushner to not stop at the hostage deal, to keep going for a historic regional peace.
Amazed, and they're thrilled, and it's an honor to be involved, and we're going to have an amazing time, and it's going to be something that's never happened before.
3 hours from now, after 738 days of waiting, the families of the hostages will be able to embrace those 20 living hostages when they are brought back here to Israel. Brian, it's an incredible time to be here and really a historic day. Ryan.
Jennifer, and think about you, who, you know, you covered this for the longest time, and we've seen so many ups and downs, and you and I together, you were on the ground with Yasser Arafat's funeral. We thought that was going to go awry, and now we've gotten to this point. So could you tell me through your sources what things are like in Gaza right now? We understand 90% of the buildings have been destroyed. Has Hamas backed out?
Well, it's truly extraordinary, Brian. I spoke to a friend in Gaza today and asked him how his house was, and he had sent me a video showing him walking towards an area that was completely rubble. This is just west of Gaza City near the beach. And then he sent me a photo of what it looked like beforehand, and it was a beautiful, gleaming, five-story building. So people are returning home. 500,000 Palestinians returned to their homes yesterday, but again, they had just what was on their backs. They were walking. What's happening in Gaza? We understand there are running gun battles between some of the Palestinian clans, the Dogmush clan and Hamas. There's retribution. There's summary killings in the streets for people suspected of collaborating with Israel. So right now, the security situation is not good. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is holding, but internally things could break down very quickly. There is not a strong security force in place, so that international security force that they're talking about really needs to get there to fill the vacuum, because we know what happens in the Middle East when there are vacuums, Brian.
All right. Thanks so much, Jennifer. Look forward to your coverage through this historic time. Over the next few hours, we'll see the president on the ground there. And before that, we'll see hostages coming out beginning at 1 a.m. Eastern, we hope. Meanwhile, there are 737 days. These hostages have been underground in many cases. They're finally being released from Hamas's terror hold. Many are still wondering, what motivated the terror group to sign this peace deal? What risk did Israel still face? And where does Gaza and the entire Middle East go from here? Let's bring in two of the best in the business, few know more. Former foreign policy advisor George W. Bush, Dan Senor, and the Foundation for Democracies CEO, Mark Dubowitz. Let's begin with you, Mark. First off, put it in perspective how we got to this point. How did President Trump use the relationships that he had to push all sides together to get to this point, to get all hostages out together?
So, Brian, President Trump did what President Biden didn't do and what Kamala Harris wouldn't have done, which is there was no daylight between Washington and Jerusalem, no daylight between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. He came into office and he provided full support to the Israelis to use military power in order to destroy and degrade Hamas. And by showing no daylight, the Israelis had the confidence, the trust to take the risks for peace, to actually do the ceasefire, get their hostages back, but take an enormous risk because Hamas has still got weapons. And as Jennifer said, they're still exacting retribution against fellow Palestinians. Hamas is responsible for all the destruction that you're going to see on your screens, all the destruction in Gaza, all the destruction in Israel, and all the lives lost.
Hey, Dan, the way I understand it, the Wall Street Journal reporting today, that Hamas looked at this deal and said, no, we're going to refuse it. 2 days later, they changed their mind. Why? Turkey, Qatar, Egypt said, you'll take this deal or you lose all our support. The relationship with Trump had a lot to do with that. Did you ever foresee those countries putting the pressure on Hamas like that?
I think just to pivot off something Mark said, Brian, once Hamas realized that the Israel and the IDF were not going to be restrained by the United States government, everyone tried to restrain Israel and its operations in Gaza. The international community did. You saw what Europe has been doing over the last few months. The UN did. The previous administration tried to. So I think Hamas, their calculations were simply that someone would rein in Israel. But the only party, I think from Hamas's perspective, that could truly rein in Israel was the Trump administration. And when the Trump administration made it clear that not only was it not going to rein in Israel, but it was going to back Israel in its operation into Gaza City. Keep in mind, Gaza City for Hamas is like their Moscow or their Berlin. It was their stronghold. It was their last stronghold. And they just assumed that Israel would not go in to Gaza City, much like they assumed that there would be huge pressure in the spring of 2024 to restrain Israel from going into Rafah. It was a very similar dynamic. Only this time, the Trump administration basically said, go in. We're not stopping them. And I think that combined with the operation in Doha made these governments in the region realize that Israel was not going to be reined in, and this the fire could spread throughout the region, and they needed to wind this thing down and put pressure on Hamas to do so. And they told Hamas, Israel's not being reined in here. Israel has a green light. And so that, what's something about coming back to Mark's point? Once Hamas and various others in the region realized there was no daylight between the Trump administration and the Israeli government, that's when things started to truly move.
So I want you both to comment on this. Mark, I want to put up a side-by-side. The celebrations in Tel Aviv, and by the way, in Gaza, where they were chanting Trump's name. And then we look at the video in a lot of these Western cities, and you posted this in London and in New York. They have anti-Israel hate signs and chants out there. Meanwhile, the people in Gaza are chanting Trump's name, and in Tel Aviv. It makes you wonder, Mark, what the goals of these protesters were to begin with, to eliminate Israel?
Well, Brian, I think it's clear. I mean, for 2 years, you know, hundreds of thousands, if millions of people have been marching in Western capitals wearing, you know, green Hamas banners and waving these flags and calling for a ceasefire. Well, it turns out that when a ceasefire actually occurs, right, Israelis are at Hostage Square, hundreds of thousands of them chanting for peace. Gazans are breathing a sigh of relief because perhaps this is the end of Hamas and certainly the end of war. And yet there are hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of London and in European capitals who are actually chanting in favor of Hamas and want this war to continue. So it turns out they didn't want a ceasefire. They wanted a ceasefire where Hamas would actually win, and winning would mean destroying Israel. So I think it really does call into question their intentions and their motivations. And not only the people on the streets, but actors and politicians and social media influencers who for 2 years have been castigating Israel. And in the past 8 months have been condemning President Trump. Well, it turns out President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu were committed to peace. They were committed to Hamas and to further destruction.
Dan, you see it every day in New York. We walk through the same streets to see the anti-Israel sentiment in these organized protests. I want to throw up in my mouth, wonder how we got here. And I think that dichotomy shows there's a reality on the ground. And these protesters don't even know what they're doing because they at least respond to the peace that's upon us.
For the last few months, but really the last 2 years, but it got most aggressive in the last few months, we have been told by all these protesters and all these folks in Hollywood and some of the other people Mark mentioned that you're citing, that this was a genocide. Now, obviously, we strongly dispute that. It was absolutely not a genocide. But we've been being told it was a genocide. Well, guess what? The genocide, if it was one, just stopped, right? The ceasefire stops the genocide. One would think that the first moral obligation of every one of these people we're talking about right now would be to celebrate the ceasefire, the quote-unquote stopping the genocide, and helping to enforce it, helping to make sure it happens. And instead, what they're revealing is that charges of genocide, much like charges of famine and charges of mass starvation and everything we've heard over the last couple of years, were never about the thing that they were talking about. They were always about using these issues as a political weapon to wage against Israel. And so even when the objective is met that they said they wanted to achieve all this time, they can't stop because it was never about that actual objective. It was about a political argument to indict Israel.
Mark, yeah, I want to bring you to the circumstances.
Go ahead. Well, I just want to say, I mean, I think Dan's exactly right. And, you know, as proof of that, I mean, as Israel waits to get back its hostages, it's also mourning the 915 Israeli soldiers who were killed in action, the 6,300 who've been maimed. If Israel was committing genocide, what would Israel have done? It would have flown heavy jets over Gaza and would have bombed Gaza to smithereens. It wouldn't have sent its boys and girls into these terror tunnels, into these booby-trap buildings, and try to minimize civilian casualties while Hamas was using civilians as human shields. So it just underscores, again, just the idiocy of these arguments and the immorality of these arguments that have been made to indict Israel, as Dan has alluded to.
And we know we are expecting in a matter of hours from three separate locations hostages to come streaming out and the bodies of those who lost their lives in captivity to come out. And there's not supposed to be any humiliation, any parading. The Red Cross is supposed to grab them and bring them forward. And there's going to be an exchange for Palestinian prisoners, 200 plus who have blood on their hands on death row. They're going to get out. Some are going to leave the country. And Dan, finally, how important was it to not only show that President Trump backed the IDF's ability to take down Gaza, but how important was it to show that they'll take action against Iran? And if you do not go sincerely engage in talks and you try to delay, we will take action. And that's what this region understands. And you understand that.
Yeah. I Amit Segel, who's a prominent Israeli journalist that Mark knows as well, was recently on my podcast, and he said, if you just look at events between the events that have occurred and the coordination between the U.S. and Israel over the last, 9-10 months, basically everything from the operation in Iran to what we've seen over the last couple of weeks we could just go on and on with event after event after event. He said, if you just watch all these events without the commentary, it's like watching a football match, he said, without the commentary, and you just watch how the game is played, you would see the U.S. and Israel standing shoulder to shoulder on every one of these events. Are there moments of tension? Of course. Are there, minute to minute, do you have moments of, disagreement? But the direction of travel was all in one direction. And it was a model, really, of how two allies should operate who are trying to pursue the same goal. And in this regard, I think the U.S. and Israel working together, the prime minister and the president, sent a very strong message, not only to both of their respective enemies, but really to the entire world, about what it looks like when the U.S. is stitched up with, in this case, its most important ally in the Middle East, to advance these objectives and to defeat barbarians.
Mark, we only have 45 seconds left. What do you expect the president to say to the Knesset tomorrow, which could be today, depending on your time zone?
Yeah, I mean, the president is personally invested in the return of the hostages at such a deep emotional level. But I think he's going to have a message of hope, a message of peace, a message of opportunity, that this may actually be the building blocks for normalization, for peace deals with the Saudis and Israel, the Indonesians, maybe the Malaysians, the Lebanese, the Syrians. I mean, President Trump, by the end of his 3 years, could usher in a new era of peace. Right. And I think for that, he will deserve and should get the Nobel Peace Prize.
Absolutely. And by the way, we got to see that international force come together quickly, or the IDF is not leaving. Dan and Mark, two better people I could not be talking to on this historic night. Thanks so much. Meanwhile, more on this show, a lot more, including the former police chief of New York City, Los Angeles, and Boston, maybe the most respected in the country, Bill Bratton, on the tension we're seeing in Portland and Chicago, the state of law and order in America. Keep it right here. You're watching One Nation. Our coverage will continue.
Don't mind me.
There's no denying that law and order is on the way back in this country. Look, for example, the success of the National Guard and ICE in major cities like Washington, D.C. Crime's down across the board. Think about it. From August 7th to the 25th, compared to last year, violent crime is down 49%. Robbery and burglary also see significant declines. ICE is on track to deport 600,000 immigrants this year here illegally. Many came over the last 4 years. And there's 2 million illegal migrants who said, the heck with it, I'm going to self-deport. But despite these successes, the anti-law enforcement rhetoric from the left continues. And it starts from the top, like guys like Governor Pritzker.
Trump and the thuggery that his agents have brought has actively made us less safe. The state of Illinois is going to use every lever at our disposal to resist this power grab and get Noam's thugs the hell out of Chicago. I'm not afraid.
Not afraid. In rogue cities like Portland, the rhetoric is even trickling down to the departments themselves, where cops are siding with the bad guys. Journalists like Nick Sorter, unfortunately, saw that with his own eyes.
This was as big of a surprise to me as it was to everybody else. All of a sudden, I'm being jumped by Antifa thugs. I get back up, I stumble away and go back toward cops where I think, at least, all right, well, maybe that'll be a safer place for me to go. Never suspected that I was going to be the target of the arrest that they were coming in to make.
It's insane. And in Chicago, ICE and Border Patrol agents on a lawful enforcement mission were followed. They were boxed in by 10 vehicles, nearly run over and shot at. And when those agents under siege called for backup from the Chicago PD, they were told they're on their own. Listen.
And again, per the chief of patrol, we have all the units that per 999, chief of patrol said all units clear out from there. We're not sending anybody over to that location.
That's pretty black and white. We're not coming for help, right? But Chicago's police chief had a different version of what happened in a presser the next day.
Do not box in any law enforcement officer. You're breaking the law when you do that.
I would never tell our officers to stand down, because if our officers were in trouble and we needed help from other officers, I would expect those officers to step in and help us. When someone is in trouble, we're going to step in.
But Chief, I hate to tell you, they were in trouble and no one stepped in and someone told them not to. Maybe it wasn't you. And in Portland, the president of the police union said he's open to federal support to help the agency combat the city's bursting crime. Joining us now is Bill Bratton, who led the police departments of some of the biggest cities in this country, New York, Los Angeles, Boston. And he's probably one of the most respected people in law enforcement in America today. Commissioner, great to see you. Your thoughts about how the lack of coordination is playing out, and specifically in Portland and Chicago?
Well, if hitting the nail on the head, it is the issue of lack of coordination, lack of collaboration. And it's unfortunate that we have a situation right now where we're finding federal law enforcement entities in conflict with local law enforcement entities. And that is one of the dilemmas that is being created at the moment with the efforts that are underway. I'm hoping that there's some resolution of this going forward, but quite frankly, right now it's a mess.
You guys are brought up to help each other, whether you're ATF, whether it's state police, local police. But now in cities like Portland and Chicago, and I imagine others, they're told, don't help ICE. Don't respond. Let the protesters take over. Let them deal with it, which prompted Trump, President Trump, to call in the National Guard. How would you deal with it?
Well, I'm not sure how extensive that issue of failure to respond, in this case, to federal requests for assistance when they are in the middle of a significant disturbance. You've got the Chicago example. We have 18,000 police departments in this country. So how widespread that issue is, conjecture at the moment. But you're correct. In law enforcement, when a brother or sister officer calls, you go. You'll sort it out later in terms of what prompted the incident that you're responding to, but you go.
What are you to do if you're in the White House and you're watching Portland have 100 days of protests in front of a federal building? What do you do if you see the west side and south side of Chicago with 50-plus shootings on average every single month and no one acting? And if you care about your people, the president wants to take action. Do you know of better action he could be taking besides the National Guard, federal troops, ATF, Border Patrol, and ICE?
Well, unfortunately, what's going on at the moment does not appear to be working in the sense of increasing disorganization in levels of cooperation and coordination between historically what has been very good cooperation between local police, federal agencies, ATF, FBI, ICE, for that matter. No, in terms of I would hope that the powers that be would take a fresh look at what is, in fact, happening. Because very often, in terms of what's being portrayed on the media and by the media and social media, the facts on the ground are not supported by what I'm seeing and I'm watching. Portland, an example. Portland is seriously problematic in a couple of locations in a city of 150 square miles. The irony of what's going on at the moment is that crime in America overall has been going down for several years. We had the problem, certainly, of crime in the 20s going back up. But throughout the country, it has been going down. It is being assisted by some of the federal efforts at the moment. But the feds can't take overall credit for what's happening. It does still require the right. Most impactful entity are still your local police forces.
Hey, I want to talk about the NYPD, and you have a front runner for the mayoral race by about 20 points who has basically called the NYPD racist, and he wants to, in the past, has said some vile things about him. He's going to take the power of discipline away from the police commissioner and set up his own council to do it. And many are bracing for a mass exodus. You've seen different politicians take control of the of Gracie Mansion. What do you fear most if he is to win?
What I would fear most, and what law enforcement that I'm certainly very intimate with, as you might expect here in this city, fear most is that he would follow through on the many statements that he has made against the NYPD and changes he would bring about. One, he has no interest in increasing the size of the force. My perspective is the force is 3,000 officers short at the moment. He's talking about taking monies away from the department, which is already short budgeted, to create other entities that he would like to begin to put in place. He's talking about closing Rikers, which I think is a major mistake, and opening four neighborhood jails with a capacity of 3,500 when the current population at Rikers is 8,000. So what is he going to do, let 5,000 people out onto the streets because he doesn't have capacity? He's talking about doing away with a unit that I created, the Strategic Response Group, which is highly trained to deal with demonstrations and disturbances. And if he does away with that group, then he's sending officers who don't have the proper training, don't have the proper supervision, into dealing with major incidents. And New York City always has major incidents day to day, week to week. No, in terms of the concern is if he follows through on his promises. And the most recent one about the idea of supporting taking the disciplinary powers of the police commissioner away. I've been a police commissioner there twice in New York City.
And commissioner, someone's going to take it who is maybe ill-equipped to do it just because they want the job, but not somebody as competent and successful as you. Commissioner Bratton, thanks so much. Appreciate it. It looks like we're heading this direction in the next few weeks. Meanwhile, straight ahead, Democratic chaos has been on full display in major governor's races across the country. And we are forever stuck in party politics. Is that the way it's always going to be? You it. We'll weigh in. And be sure to catch me on Tour History, Liberty, and Laughs, streamed on Fox Nation, Pottstown, Pennsylvania, November 1st, Fort Myers, February 14th.
Sleep in 6 minutes with this.
You know, this week, Democratic chaos was really on full display. And I bring you to the governor's races. You got California, you got Virginia, you have New Jersey. In all three, Democrats are leading. And the real question is, why are they leading? Are voters stuck in party loyalty? For example, in New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill, accused of inflating her military record, among other things, missing critical votes while sounding a lot like Kamala Harris.
If you could pass one piece of legislation, what would it be?
Right now, I would love at this point to pass legislation to send a federal block grant back to states, back to the state of New Jersey, to run some really key programs and innovate on them.
So she's going to do this right away. Can you imagine running for office and not knowing what you want to do? In California, it's been about a year. It's a year out for this election, and we had to wait till June for the primary. But Katie Porter, her campaign is in damage control. She's had a string of meltdowns in her past and in her present, and questions about her temperament.
Electrified our transportation sector, that we're going to lose more than 500,000 Californians dying prematurely to air pollution and other problems, and the state could lose. Get out of my shot.
I wanted to tell you that that's actually incorrect. It's not that it's electric vehicles. It's that if we don't meet the commitments under the Paris Climate Accord.
Okay. It does. Okay. You also were in my shot before that. Stay out of my shot.
I don't want to keep doing this. I'm going to call it. Okay. Thank you.
You're not going to do the interview with us?
Nope, not like this. I'm not. Not with 7 follow-ups to every single question you ask.
Yeah, that's the worst, follow-ups. In Virginia, Abigail Spanberger dodging questions about her support for politically toxic ally Jay Jones after vile texts resurfaced this week, back in 2022, of him fantasizing about shooting his political rivals and their kids, by the way. Still, all three Democrats are out front, looking like the real curve politics averages have them comfortably out front. Joining us now to discuss, is there a standard for Democrats when it comes to Democratic candidates, is Fox News contributor, host of the You It Show, You You It. You, have you struck this week by that theme? Were you?
Oh, yeah. I talked to Jack Cittarelli, who's running in New Jersey. I talked to Winsome Sears, who's running in Virginia. They both believe it's dead heat in New Jersey and that Winsome has closed within 4 or 5 points in Virginia and is closing closer as we get closer to the election. It's interesting. They're both blue states. These should be layups for the Democrats because it's an off year in which the incumbent in the White House is of the other party. So it should be a layup for the Democrats. It's not. Why? Because Jack Chitterelli keeps talking about property taxes, and energy costs, and Winsom Sears keeps talking about schools. Now, my grandkids go to public school in Virginia. I do not want Abigail Spanberger in charge because she will not do anything about the radicals who run the Beltway school districts. And when I say radical, I mean radical. I used to live, until I moved back to the Beltway, in Katie Porter's district. She's scary. I'd be glad to have Mickey Sherrill on my show. I'd be glad to have Abigail Spanberger. They don't say anything. Katie Porter kind of scares me. And one thing we should add, yeah. Katie Porter's trouble is occurring just as Prop 50 is about to be voted on in November, the attempt by Gavin Newsom to destroy the Republican Party in California. She's actually helping the no vote on Prop 50 because people don't want people like her and her party in charge of their lives.
A couple of things. Abigail Spanberger and I think Senator Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, they're doing the worst thing. Instead of saying like, hey, I got a socialist run for mayor, but I'm going to vote for him, they say nothing. Abigail Spanberger, instead of I want boys to dress, who trans boys to dress in girls' locker rooms, she just tries to avoid it. Instead of telling a really bad AG candidate that those texts are disqualifying, she just says it's up to people to make their own choices. In the era of Trump, they want direct answers, whether you like them or not. That's what you got to do in this political season.
I think you're right, Brian. You got to look at the camera and say Jay Jones should drop out. He is the crazed guy who is wishing death upon the Republican speaker, death upon the kid. So Abigail Spanberger had a debate this week. We can't really call it a debate because while Winsome Sears was there and ready to roll and had a great night, Abigail Spanberger looked like she'd been hit by a stun gun. She really, a blank stare into the television set for most of the debate. Up in New Jersey, the same thing happened. Mickey Sherrill fumbled around for words. Jack Chitterelli, though, he came very close 4 years ago. The issues are better for him right now. I'm feeling pretty good, even though it ought to be a 2-0 night for Democrats come November. Right. I'm feeling pretty good as a Republican in both races.
Well, that's kind of interesting. Just so you know, people should look it up. There is some Democrats that get it. The mayor of San Francisco and the mayor of San Jose. Watch what they're doing. They're getting things done. It doesn't matter what party you're on. That's got to be your focus. And lastly, the biggest story for maybe the whole term of Donald Trump or anybody's term would be the peace deal that could be cut. And it's already in motion between Israel and Hamas and the entire region. 2 years of war in Gaza, return all hostages, praise pours in for Trump. I do got to give credit to Dave Ignatius of The Washington Post, Martha Raddatz of ABC, John Meacham, historian. They did say, hey, I've been a critic, but not now. Your thoughts?
President Trump began this process when he took out Soleimani in January of 2020. Demonstrating that he could deploy power a long way when he wanted to. Then he did the Abraham Accords in the fall of 2020 before he left office for 4 years. As soon as he came back, he first established no light at all between Israel and the United States, put his arms around Netanyahu and kept them there. Then he gave the green light to Israel to do what they had to do in Lebanon, to do what they had to do in Syria, and to begin the Gaza City offensive. At the same time, in the middle of that, he gave a green light to Israel to strike Iran in Operation Midnight Hammer. Then he sent RB-2s in to obliterate the nuclear program. Most important of all, he called PM Netanyahu and had him return the last wave of Israeli bombers in Operation Midnight Hammer and during the 12-day war. He told him to bring him back, demonstrating a lot of credibility to our Arab Gulf region allies as well as Turkey. So when he asked everyone to get around the table, he brought enormous authority on both sides, enormous credibility on both sides. He sent Witkoff, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner to close the deal. Marco Rubio was working it very hard. And the deal appears closed. We'll find out on Monday night, Tuesday morning, if indeed there is a ceasefire and the hostages are home. If that happens, all credit to Donald Trump. And the people who are celebrating that he didn't get the Nobel Prize, they're doing a poker tell that they've got TDS. Because he should have gotten it. Eurocrats are going to Eurocrat. They just hate the guy for reasons related to our Norwegian weirdness. But it doesn't matter. What matters is the hostages will get home thanks to President Trump. And the hostage families know that, Brian.
Yeah, they really do. It's very rare when you heard his name chanted in Gaza and in Tel Aviv on the same day on the same deal. You very well put. Thanks for going back in time to put this whole thing in perspective. It's been a journey, and hopefully the last lap will be glorious. You would thank you. Next, Congress Roaster-in-Chief John Kennedy is here, and he outlines his plans to take on Washington. Don't move. You're watching One Nation. Glad you are. Make me smile.
Well, we're here for a good.
Senator Schumer is, he's nervous as a pregnant nun.
It's hard to believe that anyone can fit that much stupid into their head.
I think all those people need to pop a Zoloft and relax a little bit.
Anybody that tells you that they know what the short-term impact of these tariffs is going to be on the economy has been homeschooled by a day drinker.
If you hate cops just because they're cops, you don't know anything about them, then next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Few people roast Washington and logic more with charm and more truth than my next guest. He's the most quotable senator maybe ever. He is John Kennedy, and the senator has a brand new book out, Pulling No Punches. It's called How to Test Negative for Stupid and Why Washington Never Will. And joining us now is Senator Kennedy himself. Senator, who prompted you to write this book? Was it because you were seeming to be so quotable and bookable for those people who have shows like this?
Well, after I had been in the Senate for an acceptable, a reasonable period of time, Brian, I just decided I wanted to write a storybook. It's not a policy book, though I talk about policy some. A storybook about what Washington, and specifically the Senate, is really like, and why in Washington, normal is just a setting on the clothes dryer. Many of the stories are funny. Some of them are deeply bizarre.
Right.
And I think the book, you'll understand this shutdown much better if you read the book.
Well, I can hear your voice in every word because you love to read, and now we know you love to write. Here's an excerpt that I think stood out. You said, I don't hate anyone. Though my people skills are generally fine, I have a low tolerance for morons. And blue bleep. I like breakfast food and straight answers. It's hard to get straight answers in Washington, D.C., in part because common sense is illegal. That's why I'm so direct. That's why I ask tough questions, which we have seen in action. And now we're sitting now with something happening that backs up the premise of your book. It seems like we are in a shutdown. Despite being the most successful country in the world, we can't agree how to fund it.
Well, I think that's a reflection. This shutdown is a reflection of how absurd the demands are of the socialist wing of the Democratic Party, which is, of course, telling Senator Schumer what to do. We ask for, you've heard the term clean CR. That just means we didn't ask for anything to open government and negotiate a new budget for the next 6 or 7 weeks. And the loon wing and Senator Schumer have said, we'll only agree to open it if you give us $1.5 trillion. Well, we're not going to do that. If we did do that, Brian, you would see inflation go through the roof. Mm-hmm. You would see long-term interest rates go through the roof. And I don't see an end in sight. I really don't. If we're still shut down in 2 weeks, my right. suggestion is that we lock Thune and Schumer into a room with Katie Porter and tell them they can't come out till they make a deal.
Absolutely. That would be a scary sight. And lastly, just as we try to fund the government, I think the problem is, to a degree, is that you're asking for nothing and they're asking you to undo the big, beautiful bill, including a lot of the rescissions that went through. So therefore, when they say meet halfway, you're not even out of the blocks. Like, where do you want to meet? You haven't asked for anything.
Well, this is just crazy. Somebody asked me yesterday to describe it. I said it's like the game room in a mental hospital. That's what the Senate is like right now. I'm prepared to just stay shut down. I'm sorry for all the pain it's causing. Our military is not going to be paid for a while, and I'm really, the pain that is causing the American people breaks my heart. But I don't know what else to do. We can't just, they basically want us to repeal the one big beautiful bill and spend $1.5 trillion. And we can't do that. It would really hurt the country. But we can't just give the moon wing of the Democratic Party $1.5 trillion.
Right.
We can't do it. I'm not going to vote to do it.
Right. Meanwhile, you can pick up Senator Kennedy's book. It's How to Test Negative for Stupid and Why Washington Never Will. Your premise is backed up every day this shutdown goes on. Thanks, Senator. Always great to have you. Up next, more One Nation. And don't forget to follow me on social media. You got, you know, a place to go to Rumble, you go to Instagram, you go to X, you go to Facebook, where you can get exclusive and go to the Culper Club. You can find that right off Locals. Don't move. Before we go, get ready for a brand new season of What Made America Great out November 17th, only on Fox Nation. I'm going to take you inside the places and moments that shaped our nation's history as we come up to birthday 250. Here's a sneak peek at one of the episodes.
This right here is the bloodiest battlefield of the entire 18th century in all of North America.
And I believe we got our target.
By the time they got here, they were full of confidence. The type of fighting really turned the tide of the July 2nd battle.
I think you're going to love this series. This five might be the best, and we've had about 26 done already. Meanwhile, tune into my radio show from 9 to noon, Monday through Friday. You don't want to miss. Go to BrianKilmeadShow.com if you're not in our family as affiliates. And always watch Fox and Friends every single day from 6 to 9 a.m. And keep in mind this, the one philosophy that can make your life better. Stay within yourself, and always keep it right here on Fox News.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.